by a medal or a cash award, or even the praise one gets from colleagues or the public, but the prize of actually learning something new about nature. In this sense, the 1970s were perhaps the richest decade in the 20th century, if not in the entire history of physics. In 1970, we understood only one force in nature completely as a quantum theory, namely quantum electrodynamics. By 1979, we had developed and experimentally verified perhaps the greatest theoretical edifice yet created by human minds, the Standard Model of Particle Physics, describing precisely three of the four known forces in nature. The effort spanned the entire history of modern science, from Galileo's investigations of the nature of moving bodies, through Newton's discovery of the laws of motion, through the experimental and theoretical investigations of the nature of electromagnetism, through Einstein's unification of space and time, through the discoveries of the nucleus, quantum mechanics, protons, neutrons, and the discovery of the weak and strong forces themselves. But the most remarkable characteristic of all in this long march toward the light is how different the fundamental nature of reality is from the shadows of reality that we experience every day, and in particular, how the fundamental quantities that appear to govern our existence are not fundamental at all. Making up the heart of observed matter are particles that had never been directly observed and, if we are correct, will never be directly observable, quarks and gluons. The properties of forces that govern the interaction of these particles, and also the particles that have formed the basis of modern experimental physics for more than a century, electrons, are also, on a fundamental level, completely different from the properties we directly observe and on which we depend for our existence. The strong interaction between protons and neutrons is only a long-distance remnant of the underlying force between quarks, whose fundamental properties are masked by the complicated interactions within the nucleus. The weak interaction and the electromagnetic interaction, which could not be more different on the surface, one is short range while the other is long range, and one appears thousands of times weaker than the other, are in fact intimately related and reflect different facets of a single whole. That whole is hidden from us because of the accident of nature we call spontaneous symmetry breaking, which distinguishes the two weak and electromagnetic interactions in the world of our experience and hides their true nature. More than that, the properties of the particles that produce the characteristics of the beautiful world we observe around us are only possible because, after the accident of spontaneous symmetry breaking, just one particle in nature, the photon, remains massless. If symmetry breaking had never occurred, so the underlying symmetries of the forces governing matter were manifest, which in turn would mean that the particles conveying the weak force would also be massless, as would most of the particles that make us up. Essentially nothing we see in the universe today, from galaxies to stars to planets to people to birds and bees to scientists and politicians, would ever have formed. Moreover, we have learned that even these particles that make us up are not all that exist in nature. The observed particles combine in simple groupings or families. The up and down quarks make up protons and neutrons. Along with them, one finds the electron and its partner, the electron neutrino. Then, for reasons we still don't understand, there is a heavier family made up of the charm and strange quark on the one hand and the muon and its neutrino on the other. And finally, as experiments have now confirmed over the past decade or two, there's a third family made of two new types of quarks called bottom and top, and an accompanying heavy version of the electron called the tau particle, along with its neutrino. Beyond these particles, as I shall soon describe, we have every reason to expect that other elementary particles exist that have never been observed. While these particles, which we think make up the mysterious dark matter that dominates the mass of our galaxy and all observed galaxies, may be invisible to our telescopes, our observations and theories nevertheless suggest that galaxies and stars could never have formed without the existence of dark matter. And at the heart of all the forces governing the dynamical behavior of everything we can observe is a beautiful mathematical framework called gauge symmetry. All of the known forces, strong, weak, electromagnetic, and even gravity, possess this mathematical property. And for the three former examples, it is precisely this property that ensures that the theories make mathematical sense and that nasty quantum infinities disappear from all calculations of quantities that can be compared to experiment. With the exception of electromagnetism, these other symmetries remain completely hidden from view. The gauge symmetry of the strong force is hidden because confinement presumably hides the fundamental particles that manifest this symmetry. The gauge symmetry of the weak force is not manifest in the world in which we live because it is spontaneously broken, so that the W and Z particles become extremely massive. The shadows on the wall of everyday life are truly merely shadows. In this sense, the greatest story ever told, so far, has been slowly playing out over the more than 2,000 years since Plato first imagined it in his analogy of the cave. But as remarkable as this story is, two elephants remain in the room. Two protagonists in our tale could, until recently, have meant that the key aspects of this story comprised a mere fairy tale, invented by theorists with overactive imaginations. First, the W and Z particles, postulated in 1960 to explain the weak interaction, almost 100 times more massive than protons and neutrons, were still mere theoretical postulates, even if the indirect evidence for their existence was overwhelming. More than this, an invisible field, the Higgs field, was predicted to permeate all of space, masking the true nature of reality and making our existence possible because it spontaneously breaks the symmetry between the weak and the electromagnetic interactions. To celebrate a story that claims to describe how it is that we exist, but that also posits an invisible field permeating all of space, sounds suspiciously like a religious celebration, not a scientific one. To truly ensure that our beliefs conform to the evidence of reality, rather than how we would like reality to be, to keep science worthy of the name, we had to discover the Higgs field. Only then could we truly know if the significance of the features of our world that we hold so dear might be no greater than that of the features of one random ice crystal on a window. Or, more to the point, perhaps no greater than the significance of the superconducting nature of wire in a laboratory versus the normal resistance of the wires in my computer. The experimental effort to carry out this task was no easier than that in developing the theory itself. In many ways, it was more daunting, taking more than 50 years and involving the most difficult fabrication of technology that humans have ever attempted. Chapter 20. Spanking the Vacuum. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Matthew, chapter 5, verse 39. As the 1970s ended, theorists were on top of the world, triumphant and exultant. With progress leading to the Standard Model so swift, what other new worlds were there to conquer? Dreams of a theory of everything, long dormant, began to rise again, and not just in the dim recesses of the collective subconscious of theorists. Still, the W and Z gauge particles had never actually been observed, and the challenge to directly observe them was pretty daunting. Their masses were precisely predicted in the theory at about 90 times the mass of the proton. The challenge to produce these particles comes from a simple bit of physics. Einstein's fundamental equation of relativity, E equals mc squared, tells us that we can convert energy into mass by accelerating particles to energies of many times their rest mass. We can then smash them into targets to see what comes out. The problem is that the energy available to produce new particles by smashing other fast-moving particles into stationary targets is given by what is called the center of mass energy. For those undaunted by another formula, this turns out to be the square root of twice the product of the energy of the accelerated particle times the rest mass energy of the target particle. Imagine accelerating a particle to 100 times the rest mass energy of the proton, which is about 1 giga electron volt, or GeV. In a collision with stationary protons in a target, the center of mass energy that is available to create new particles is then only about 14 GeV. This is just slightly greater than the center of mass energy available in the highest energy particle accelerator in 1972. To reach the energies required to produce massive particles such as the W or Z bosons, two opposing beams of particles must collide. In this case, the total center of mass energy is simply twice the energy of each beam. If each colliding beam of particles has an energy of 100 times the rest mass of the proton, this then yields 200 GeV of energy to be converted into the mass of a new particle. Why, then, produce accelerators with stationary targets and not colliders? The answer is simple. If I'm shooting a bullet at a barn door, I am more or less guaranteed to hit something. If I shoot a bullet at another incoming bullet, however, I'd have to be a much better shot than probably anyone else alive and have a better gun than any now made to be guaranteed to hit it. This was the challenge facing experimentalists in 1976, by which time they took the electroweak model seriously enough that they thought it worth the time, effort, and money to try and test it. But no one knew how to build a device with the appropriate energy. Accelerating individual beams of particles or antiparticles to high energies had been achieved. By 1976, protons were being accelerated to 500 GeV and electrons up to 50 GeV. At lower energies, collisions of electrons and their antiparticles had successfully been carried out, and this is how the new particle containing the charmed quark and antiquark had been discovered in 1974. Protons, having greater mass and thus more rest energy initially, protons are easier to accelerate to higher energies. In 1976, a proton accelerator at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, CERN, in Geneva, the Super Proton Synchrotron, or SPS, had just been commissioned as a conventional fixed-target accelerator operating with a proton beam at 400 GeV. However, another accelerator at Fermilab near Chicago had already achieved proton beams of 500 GeV by the time the SPS turned on. In June of that year, physicists Carlo Rubbia, Peter McIntyre, and David Klein made a bold suggestion at a neutrino conference, converting the SPS at CERN into a machine that collided protons with their antiparticles, antiprotons, would allow CERN to potentially produce W's and Z's. Their bold idea was to use the same circular tunnel to accelerate protons in one direction and antiprotons in another. Since the two particles have opposite electric charges, the same accelerating mechanism would have opposite effects on each particle. So a single accelerator could in principle produce two high-energy beams circulating in opposite directions. The logic of such a proposal was clear, but its implementation was not. In the first place, given the strength of the weak interaction, the production of even a few W and Z particles would require the collision of hundreds of billions of protons and antiprotons. But no one had ever produced and collected enough antiprotons to make an accelerator beam. Next, you might imagine that with two beams traversing the same tunnel in opposite directions, particles would be colliding all around the tunnel, and not in the detectors designed to measure the products of the collisions. However, this is far from the case. The cross-section of even a small tunnel, compared to the size of the region over which a proton and an antiproton might collide, is so huge that the problem is quite the opposite. It seemed impossible to produce enough antiprotons and ensure that both they and the protons in the proton beam would be sufficiently compressed so that when the two beams were brought together, steered by powerful magnets, any collisions at all would be observed. Convincing the CERN directorate to transform one of the world's most powerful accelerators, built in a circular tunnel almost 8 kilometers around at the French-Swiss border, into a new kind of collider would have been difficult for many people. But Carlo Rubbia, a bombastic force of nature, was up to the task. Few people who got in Rubbia's way were likely to be happy about it afterward. For 18 years, he jetted every week between CERN and Harvard, where he was a professor. His office was 2 floors down from mine, but I knew when he was in town because I could hear him. Moreover, Rubbia's idea was good. And in promoting it, he was really suggesting to CERN that the SPS move up from an also-ran machine to the most exciting accelerator in the world. As Sheldon Glashow said to the CERN directorate when encouraging them to move forward, quote, "Do you want to walk or do you want to fly?" End quote. Still, to fly one needs wings, and the creation of a new method to produce, store, accelerate, and focus a beam of antiprotons fell to a brilliant accelerator physicist at CERN, Simon van der Meer. His method was so clever that many physicists who first heard about it thought it violated some fundamental principles of thermodynamics. The properties of the particles in the beam would be measured at one place in the circular tunnel, then a signal would be sent from magnets further down the tunnel to give many small kicks over time to the particles in the beam as they passed by, thus slightly altering the energies and momenta of any wayward particles so that they would eventually all get focused into a narrow beam. The method, called stochastic cooling, helped make sure particles that were wandering away from the center of the beam would be sent back into the middle. Together, van der Meer and Rubbia pushed forward, and by 1981, the collider was working as planned, and Rubbia assembled the largest physics collaboration ever created and built a large detector capable of sorting through billions of collisions of protons and antiprotons to search for a handful of possible W and Z particles. Rubbia's team was not the only one hunting for a W and Z, however. Another detector collaboration had been assembled and was also built at CERN. Redundancy for such an important observation seemed appropriate. Unearthing a signal from the immense background of these experiments was not easy. Remember that protons are made of more than one quark, and in a single proton-antiproton collision, a lot of things can happen. Moreover, the W's and Z's would not be observed directly, but via their decays. In the case of the W, into electrons and neutrinos. Neutrinos would not be directly observed either. Rather, the experimentalists would tally up the total energy and momentum of each outgoing particle in a candidate event and look for large amounts of, quote, missing energy, unquote, which would signal that a neutrino had been produced. By December 1982, a W candidate had been observed by Rubbia and his colleagues. Rubbia was eager to publish a paper based on this single event, but his colleagues were more cautious, for good reason. Rubbia seemed to have a history of making discoveries that weren't always there. In the meantime, he leaked details of the event to a number of colleagues around the world. Over the next few weeks, his UA1 collaboration obtained evidence for 5 more W candidate events, and the UA1 physicists designed several far more stringent tests to ascertain with high confidence that the candidates were real. On January 20th, 1983, Rubbia presented a memorable and masterful seminar at CERN announcing the result. The standing ovation he received made it clear that the physics community was convinced. A few days later, Rubbia submitted a paper to the journal Physics Letters announcing the discovery of 6 W events. The W had been discovered with precisely the predicted mass. The search was not over, however. The Z remained to be seen. Its predicted mass was slightly heavier than that of the W, and its signal was therefore slightly harder to obtain. Nevertheless, within a month or so of the W announcement, evidence for Z events began to come in from both experiments. And on the basis of a single clear event on May 27th that year, Rubbia announced its discovery. the gauge bosons of the electroweak model had been found. The significance of these discoveries for solidifying the empirical basis of the Standard Model was underscored when, just slightly over a year after making the announcement, Rubbia and his accelerator colleague, Vandermeer, were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. While the teams that had built and operated both the accelerator and the detectors were huge, few could deny that without Rubbia's drive and persistence and Vandermeer's ingenious invention, the discovery would not have been possible. One big holy grail now remained: the purported Higgs particle. Unlike the W and Z bosons, the mass of the Higgs is not fixed by the theory. Its couplings to matter and to gauge bosons were predicted, as these couplings allow the background Higgs field that presumably exists in nature to break the gauge symmetry and give mass not to just the W and the Z, but also to electrons, muons, and quarks. Indeed, to all the fundamental particles in the Standard Model, save the neutrino and the photon. However, neither the Higgs particle mass nor the strength of its self-interactions was separately determined in advance by then-existing measurements. Only their ratio was fixed by the theory in terms of the measured strength of the weak interaction between known particles. Given conservative estimates of the possible magnitude of the Higgs self-interaction strength, the Higgs particle mass was conservatively estimated to lie within a range of 2 to 2,000 GeV. What set the upper limit was that if the Higgs self-coupling is too big, then the theory becomes strongly interacting, and many of the calculations performed using the simplest picture of the Higgs breaks down. Aside from their necessary role in breaking the electroweak symmetry and giving other elementary particles masses, these quantitative details were therefore largely undetermined by experiments up to that time. Which is probably why Sheldon Glashow in the 1980s referred to the Higgs as the toilet of modern physics. Everyone was aware of its necessary existence, but no one wanted to talk about the details in public. That the Standard Model didn't fix in advance many of the details of the Higgs field didn't dissuade many theorists from proposing models that quote-unquote predicted the Higgs mass based on some new theoretical ideas. In the early 1980s, each time accelerators increased their energies, new physics papers would come out predicting a Higgs would be discovered when the machine was turned on. Then, a new threshold would be reached and nothing would be observed. To explore all the available parameter space to see if the Higgs existed, a radically new accelerator would clearly have to be built. I was convinced during all this time that the Higgs didn't exist. The spontaneous symmetry breaking of the electroweak gauge symmetry did certainly occur. The W and the Z exist and have mass. But adding a fundamental new scalar field designed by recipe specifically to perform this task seemed contrived to me. First, no other fundamental scalar field had ever been observed to exist in nature's particle menagerie. Second, I felt that with all of the unknown physics yet to be discovered at small scales, nature would have developed a much more ingenious and unexpected way of breaking the gauge symmetry. Once one posits the Higgs particle, then the next obvious question is, why that? Or more specifically, why just the right dynamics to cause it to condense at that scale and with that mass? I thought that nature would find a way to break the theory in a less ad hoc fashion. And I expressed this conviction fairly strongly when I was interviewed for my eventual position at the Society of Fellows at Harvard after getting my PhD. Let's recall now what the existence of the Higgs implies. It requires not just a new particle in nature, but an invisible background field that must exist throughout all of space. It also implies that all particles, not just the W and Z particles, but also electrons and quarks, are massless in the fundamental theory. These particles that interact with the Higgs background field then experience a kind of resistance to their motion that slows their travel to less than the speed of light, just as a swimmer in molasses will move more slowly than a swimmer in water. Once they are moving at sub-light speed, the particles behave as if they are massive. Those particles that interact more strongly with this background field will experience a greater resistance and will act as if they are more massive. Just as a car that goes off the road into mud will be harder to push than if it were on the pavement. And to those pushing it, it will seem heavier. This is a remarkable claim about the nature of reality. Remembering that in superconductors, the condensate that forms is a complicated state of bound pairs of electrons, I was skeptical that things would work out so much more simply and cleanly on fundamental scales in empty space. So, how to explore such a remarkable claim? We use the central property of quantum field theory that was exploited by Higgs himself when he proposed his idea. For every new field in nature, at least one new type of elementary particle must exist with that field. How then to produce the particles if such a background field exists throughout space? Simple. We spank the vacuum. By this I mean that if we focus enough energy at a single point in space, we can excite real Higgs particles to emerge and be measured. One can picture this as follows. In the language of elementary particle physics, using Feynman diagrams, we could think of a virtual Higgs particle emerging from the background Higgs field, giving mass to other particles. In the attached PDF, figure 20A, the diagram on the left-hand side corresponds to particles such as quarks and electrons scattering off a virtual Higgs particle and being deflected, thus experiencing resistance to their forward motion. The right diagram represents the same effect for particles such as the W and Z. We can then simply turn this picture around, as shown in the attached PDF, figure 20B. In this case, energetic particles such as W's and Z's, or quarks, and or antiquarks, or electrons, and or positrons, appear to emit virtual Higgs particles and recoil. If the energies of the incoming particles are large enough, then the emitted Higgs could be a real particle. If they aren't, the Higgs would be a virtual particle. Now remember that if the Higgs gives mass to particles, then the particles it interacts with most strongly will be the particles that get the largest masses. In turn, this means that the particles most likely to spit out a Higgs are the incident particles with the heaviest masses. That means that light particles such as electrons are probably not a good bet to directly create Higgs particles in an accelerator. Instead, we can imagine creating an accelerator with enough energy so that we can create heavy virtual particles that will spit out Higgs particles, either virtual or real. The natural candidates are then protons. Build an accelerator or a collider starting with protons and accelerate them to high enough energies to produce enough virtual heavy constituents so as to produce Higgs particles. The Higgs particles, virtual or real, being heavy, will quickly decay into lighter particles that the Higgs interacts with most strongly. Once again, either the top or bottom quarks or W's and Z's. These in turn will decay into other particles. The trick would be to consider events with the smallest number of outgoing particles that could be cleanly detected, then determine their energies and momentum precisely, and see if one could reconstruct a series of events traceable to a single massive intermediate particle with the predicted interaction of a Higgs particle. No small task. These ideas were already clear as early as 1977, even before the discovery of the top quark itself, since the bottom quark had already been discovered and all the other quarks came in weak pairs, up and down, charm and strange, clearly another quark had to exist, although it took until 1995 to discover it, a whopping 175 times heavier than the proton. But knowing what was required and actually building a machine capable of doing the job were two different things. Chapter 21. Gothic Cathedrals of the 21st Century. The price of wisdom is above rubies. Job, chapter 28, verse 18. Accelerating protons to high enough energies to explore the full range of possible Higgs masses was well beyond the capabilities of any machine in 1978, when all the other predictions of the electroweak theory were confirmed, or in 1983, when the W and Z had been discovered. An accelerator at least an order of magnitude more powerful than the most powerful machine then in existence was required. In short, not a collider, but a super collider. The United States, which for the entire period since the end of the Second World War had dominated science and technology, had good reason to want to build such a machine. After all, CERN in Geneva had emerged by 1984 as the dominant particle physics laboratory in the world. American pride was so hurt when both the W and the Z particles were discovered at CERN that 6 days after the press conference announcing the Z discovery, the New York Times published an editorial titled, "Europe 3, U.S. Not Even Z0." Within a week after the Z discovery, American physicists decided to cancel construction of an intermediate-scale accelerator in Long Island and go for broke. They would build a massive accelerator with center of mass energy almost 100 times greater than the CERN SPS machine. To do so, they would need new superconducting magnets, so their brainchild was named the Superconducting Supercollider, or SSC. After the project was proposed by the U.S. particle physics community in 1983, the traditional scramble proceeded among many different states to get a piece of the enormous fiscal pie for its construction and management. After much political and scientific wrangling, a site just south of Dallas, Texas, in Waxahachie, was chosen. Whatever the motivation, Texas seemed particularly appropriate, as everything about the project, which was approved in 1987 by President Reagan, was supersized. The huge underground tunnel would have been 87 kilometers around, the largest tunnel ever constructed. The project would be 20 times bigger than any other physics project ever attempted. The proposed energy of collisions, with two beams each having an energy 20,000 times the mass of the proton, would be about 100 times larger than the collision energy of the machine at CERN that had discovered the W and the Z. 10,000 superconducting magnets, each of unprecedented strength, would have been required. Cost overruns, lack of international cooperation, a poor U.S. economy, and political machinations eventually led to the SSC's demise in October 1993. I remember the time well. I had recently moved from Yale to become chair of the physics department at Case Western Reserve University, with a mandate to rebuild the department and hire 12 new faculty members over 5 years. The first year we advertised, in 1993-1994, we received more than 200 applications from senior scientists who had been employed at the SSC and who were now without a job or any prospects. Many of them were very senior, having left full professorships at distinguished universities to spearhead the effort. It was sad, and more than half of those people had to leave the field altogether. The anticipated cost of the project, when it was canceled, had risen from $4.4 billion at its inception in 1987 to about $12 billion in 1993. While this was, and still is, a large amount of money, one can debate the merits of killing the project. $2 billion had already been spent on it, and 24 kilometers of tunnel had been completed. The decision to kill the project was not black and white, but a number of things could have played a bigger role in considerations, from the opportunity costs of losing a fair fraction of the talented accelerator physicists and particle physics experimentalists in the country, to the many new breakthroughs that might have resulted from the expenditures on high-tech development that would have contributed to our economy. Moreover, had the SSC been built and functioned as planned, we may have had answers more than a decade ago to experimental questions we are still addressing. Would knowing the answers have changed anything we might have done in the meantime? We'll probably never know. The $12 billion would have been spent over some 10 to 15 years during construction and the commencement of operations, which makes the cost in the range of $1 billion per year. In the federal budget, this is not a large amount. My own political views are well known, so it may not be surprising for me to suggest, for example, that the United States would have been just as secure had it cut the bloated U.S. defense budget by this amount, far less than 1% of its total each year. Moreover, the entire cost of the SSC would probably have been comparable to the air conditioning and transportation costs of the disastrous 2003 Iraq invasion, which decreased our net security and well-being. I can't help referring once again to Robert Wilson's testimony before Congress regarding the Fermilab accelerator. It has nothing to do directly with defending our country, except to help make it worth defending. These are political questions, however, not scientific ones, and in a democracy, Congress, representing the public, has the right and responsibility to oversee priorities for expenditures on large public projects. The particle physics community, perhaps too used to a secure inflow of money during the Cold War, did not do an adequate job of informing the public and Congress what the project was all about. It is not surprising that in hard economic times, the first thing to be cut would be something that seems so esoteric. I wondered at the time why it was necessary to kill the project rather than suspend funding until the economy improved or until technological developments might have reduced its cost. Neither the tunnel, now filling with water, nor the laboratory buildings, now occupied by a chemical company, were going anywhere. Despite these developments in the United States, CERN was moving forward with a new machine, the Large Electron Positron, or LEP Collider, designed to explore in detail the physics of the W and the Z particles, at the urging of its newest Nobel laureate, the indomitable Carlo Rubbia. He became the laboratory's director in 1989, the same year the new machine came online. A 27-kilometer-long circular tunnel was dug about 100 meters underground around the old SPS machine, which was now used to inject electrons and positrons into the bigger ring, where they were further accelerated to huge energies. Located on the outskirts of Geneva, the new machine was large enough to cross under the Jura Mountains into France. European nations are more familiar with building tunnels than the United States is, and when the tunnel was completed, the two ends met up to within 1 centimeter. Moreover, CERN, as an international collaboration of many countries, did not significantly eat into the GDP of any one country. The new machine ran successfully for more than a decade, and after the demise of the SSC in the United States, the huge LEP tunnel was considered for the creation of a mini version of the SSC, not quite as powerful, but still energetic enough to explore much of the parameter space where the long-sought Higgs particle might exist. Some competition came from a machine at Fermilab called the Tevatron, which had been running since 1976, and in 1984 came online as the world's most energetic proton-antiproton machine. By 1986, the collision energy of protons and antiprotons circling around the 6.5-kilometer ring of superconducting magnets at Fermilab was almost 2,000 times the equivalent rest mass energy of the proton. As significant as this was, it was not sufficient to probe most of the available parameter space for the Higgs. And the discovery of the Tevatron would have required nature to have been kind. The Tevatron did garner one great success, the long-anticipated discovery in 1995 of the mammoth top quark, 175 times the mass of the proton, and the most massive particle yet discovered in nature. With no clear competition, therefore, within 14 months of the demise of the SSC, the CERN Council approved the construction of a new machine, the Large Hadron Collider, in the LEP tunnel. Design and development of the machine and detectors would take some time to complete, so the LEP machine would continue to operate in the tunnel for almost another 6 years before having to close down for reconstruction. It would then take almost another decade to complete construction of the machine and the particle detectors to be used in the search for the Higgs and or other new physics. That is, if a working machine and viable detectors could be constructed. This would be the most complicated engineering task humans had ever undertaken. The design specifications for superconducting magnets, computing facilities, and many other aspects of the machine and detectors called for technology far exceeding anything then available. Conceptual design of the machine took a full year, and another year later, two of the main experimental detector collaboration proposals were approved. The United States, with no horses in this race, was admitted as an observer state to CERN, allowing U.S. physicists to become key players in detector development and design. In 1998, construction of the cavern to hold one of the two major detectors, the CMS detector, was delayed for 6 months as workers discovered 4th-century Gallo-Roman ruins, including a villa and surrounding fields, on the site. 4.5 years later, the huge caverns that would house both main detectors underground were completed. Over the next 2 years, 1,232 huge magnets, each 15 meters long and weighing 35 tons, were lowered 50 meters below the surface in a special shaft and delivered to their final destinations using a specially designed vehicle that could travel in the tunnel. A year after that, the final pieces of each of the two large detectors were lowered into place. And at 10:28 a.m., September 10th, 2008, the machine officially turned on for the first time. 2 weeks later, disaster struck. A short occurred in one of the magnet connectors, causing the associated superconducting magnet to go normal, releasing a huge amount of energy and resulting in mechanical damage and release of some of the liquid helium cooling the machine. The damage was extensive enough that a redesign and reexamination of every weld and connection in the LHC was required, taking more than a year to complete. In November of 2009, the LHC was finally turned back on, but because of design concerns, it was set to run at 7,000 times the center of mass energy, the proton, instead of 14,000. On March 19, 2010, the machine finally began running with colliding beams at the lower energy, and both sets of detectors began to record collisions with this total energy within 2 weeks. These simple timelines belie the incredible challenges of the technical feats achieved at CERN during the 15 years since the machine was first proposed. If you land at Geneva Airport and look outside, you will see gentle farmland with mountains in the distance. Without being told, no one would guess that underneath that farmland lies the most complicated machine humans have ever constructed. Consider some of the characteristics of the machine, which lies at some points 175 meters below this calm and pastoral scene. 1. In the 3.8 meter wide tunnel, traversing 27 kilometers, are two parallel beamline circles, intersecting at four points around the ring. Distributed around the ring are more than 1,600 superconducting magnets, most weighing more than 27 tons. The tunnel is so long that looking down on it, one can almost not see its curvature, as is shown in the attached PDF, figure 21A. 2. 96 tons of superfluid helium-4 are used to keep the magnets operating at a temperature of less than 2 degrees above absolute zero, colder than the temperature of the radiation background in the depths of interstellar space. In total, 120 tons of liquid helium are utilized, cooled first by using about 10,000 tons of liquid nitrogen. Some 40,000 leak-tight pipe connections had to be made. The volume of helium used makes the LHC the largest cryogenic facility in the world. 3. The vacuum in the beamlines is required to be sparser than the vacuum in outer space experienced by the astronauts performing spacewalks outside the International Space Station, and 10 times lower than the atmospheric pressure on the moon. The largest volume at the LHC pumped down to vacuum level is 9,000 cubic meters, comparable to the volume of a large cathedral. 4. The protons accelerated around the tunnel in either direction move at a speed of 0.99999991 times the speed of light, or only about 3 meters per second less than light speed. The energy possessed by each proton in the collision is equivalent to the energy of a flying mosquito, but compressed into a radial dimension 1 million million times smaller than a mosquito's length. 5. Each beam of protons is bunched into 2,808 separate bunches, squeezed at collision points to about one quarter the width of a human hair around the ring, with 115 billion protons in each bunch, yielding bunch collisions every 25 billionths of a second, with more than 600 million particle collisions per second. 6. The computer grid designed to handle data from the LHC is the largest in the world. Every second, the raw data generated by the LHC are enough to fill more than 1,001 terabyte hard drives. This must be reduced considerably to be analyzed. From the 6 million billion proton-proton collisions analyzed in 2012 alone, more than 25,000 terabytes of data were processed, more than the amount of information in all the books ever written, and corresponding to a stack of CDs about 20 kilometers tall. To do this, a worldwide computer grid was created with 170 computer centers in 36 countries. When the machine is running, about 700 megabytes per second of data are produced. 7. The requirements for the 1600 magnets to produce beams intense enough to collide is equivalent to firing two needles from a distance of 10 kilometers with such precision that they collide exactly halfway between the two firing positions. 8. The alignment of the beams is so precise that account must be taken for the tidal variations on the ring from the gravity of the moon as its position over Geneva changes, causing a variation of 1 millimeter in the circumference of the LHC each day. 9. To produce the incredibly intense magnetic fields needed to steer the proton beams, a current of almost 12,000 amps flows through each of the superconducting magnets, about 120 times the current flowing through an average family house. 10. The strands of cable needed to make up the magnetic coils in the LHC span about 270,000 kilometers, or about 6 times the circumference of the Earth. If all the filaments in the strands were unraveled, they would stretch to the sun and back more than 5 times. 11. The total energy in each beam is about the same as that of a 400-ton train traveling at 150 kilometers per hour. This is enough energy to melt 500 kilograms of copper. The energy stored in the superconducting magnets is 30 times higher than this. 12. Even with the superconducting magnets, which make power consumption in the machine manageable, when the machine is running, it uses about the same power as the total consumption of all the households in Geneva. So much for the machine itself. To analyze the collisions at the LHC, a variety of large detectors have been built. Each of the 4 currently operating detectors has the size of a significant office building and the complexity of a major laboratory. To have the opportunity to go underground and see the detectors is to feel like Gulliver in Brobdingnag. The scale of absolutely every component is immense. In the attached figure, 21B, is a photo of the CMS detector, the smaller of the two largest detectors at the LHC. If you are actually at the detector, it is hard to even grasp the full picture, as can be seen in the more close-up and personal view shown in the attached PDF, figure 21C. The complexity of the machines is almost unfathomable. For a theorist such as me, it is hard to imagine how any single group of physicists can keep track of the device, much less design and build it to the exacting specifications required. Each of the two largest detectors, Atlas and CMS, was built by a collaboration of over 2,000 scientists. More than 10,000 scientists and engineers from over 100 countries participated in building the machine and detectors. Consider the smaller of the two detectors, CMS. It is more than 20 meters long, 15 meters high, and 15 meters wide. Some 12,500 tons of iron are in the detector, more than in the Eiffel Tower. The two halves of the detector are separated by a few meters when it is being worked on. Even though they are not on wheels, if the two halves were apart when the large magnetic field of the detector was turned on, they would be dragged together. Each detector is separated into millions of components, with trackers that can measure particle trajectories to an accuracy of 10 millionths of a meter, with calorimeters which detect to a high accuracy energy deposited in the detectors, and with devices for measuring the speed of particles by measuring the radiation they emit as they traverse the detector. In each collision, hundreds or thousands of individual particles may be produced, and the detector must keep track of almost all of them to reconstruct each event. Physicist Victor Weisskopf was the fourth Director General of CERN between 1961 and 1966, and he likened the great accelerators of that time to the Gothic cathedrals of medieval Europe. In thinking of CERN and the LHC, the comparison is particularly interesting. The Gothic cathedrals stretched the technology of the time, requiring new building techniques and new tools to be created. Hundreds or thousands of master craftsmen from dozens of countries built them over many decades. Their scale dwarfed that of any buildings that had previously been created. And they were built for no more practical reason than to celebrate the glory of God. The LHC is the most complicated machine ever built, requiring new building techniques and new tools to be created. Thousands of PhD scientists and engineers from hundreds of countries, speaking dozens of languages and hailing from a background of at least an equal number of religions, were required to build the accelerator and the detectors that monitor it, taking almost two decades to complete the task. Its scale dwarfs that of all machines constructed before it, and it was built for no more practical reason than to celebrate and explore the beauty of nature. Seen in this perspective, the cathedrals and the collider are both monuments to what may be the best about human civilization, the ability and the will to imagine and construct objects of a scale and complexity that requires the cooperation of countless individuals from around the globe if necessary, for the purpose of turning our awe and wonder of the workings of the cosmos into something concrete that may improve the human condition. Colliders and cathedrals are both works of incomparable grandeur that celebrate the human experience in different realms. Nevertheless, I think the LHC wins, and its successful construction over two decades demonstrates that the 21st century is not yet devoid of culture and imagination. Which brings me finally to the road to July 4th, 2012. By 2011, the LHC was cruising along, as one of the CERN officials put it. The amount of data taken by October of that year was already 4 million times higher than during the first run in 2010, and 30 times higher than had been obtained by the beginning of 2011. At this point in the collection of data that physicists had been waiting 40 years for, rumors began to fly in the community. Many of these came from the experimenters themselves. I have a part-time position at Australian National University in Canberra, and the International Conference on High Energy Physics was going to be held in Melbourne in July of 2012. Melbourne has a big LHC contingent, and when visiting, I kept hearing how a greater and greater possible mass range for the Higgs particle had been ruled out by the experiments already. Many experimentalists relish being able to prove theorists wrong. So it was in this case. One experimentalist had excitedly told me less than 6 months before the meeting that the entire Higgs mass region had been ruled out except for a narrow range between 120 and 130 times the mass of the proton. She expected that by July, they would be able to rule out that region too. As one who is skeptical of the Higgs, I wasn't unhappy to hear this. In fact, I was getting a paper ready to explain why the Higgs might not exist. On April 5th, the situation got more interesting as the LHC center of mass beam energy was increased slightly to 8,000 times the rest energy of the proton. This translated into an increased potential for new particle discovery. By mid-June, it was announced that the leaders of the two main experiments, along with the Director General of CERN, would not be traveling to Melbourne for the meeting, but would be presenting results remotely from a televised conference on the morning of July 4th in the main colloquium room at CERN, the same room where Rubbia had announced the discovery of the W particles. On July 4th, I was at a physics meeting in Aspen, Colorado. Because of the significance of the impending announcement, the physics community there had set up a live remote presentation screen so that at 1 a.m. we could all sit and watch history unfold. About 15 of us showed up in the dark at the Aspen Center for Physics, mostly physicists, but a few journalists, including Dennis Overby from the New York Times, who knew he was going to have a late night writing. As it turned out, so would I. The Times had asked me for an essay for the following week's Science Times section, if things worked out as expected. Then the show began, and in the next 45 minutes or so, spokespeople presented data from both of the two large detectors that compellingly demonstrated the existence of a new elementary particle with mass of about 125 times the mass of the proton. After the initial catastrophe in 2009, the LHC had functioned impeccably, as had both the detectors. I and many of my colleagues were amazed during the early months of the immaculately clean results the detectors displayed regarding known background processes. So we were not surprised that when something new appeared, these detectors could find it, in spite of the unbelievably complicated environment that the detectors were functioning in. But more than this, the particle was discovered by looking precisely at the decay channels that had been predicted for a standard model Higgs particle. The relative decays into photons via intermediate top quarks, or Ws, versus particles such as electrons via intermediate Z bosons agreed more or less with what was predicted, as did the production rate of the new particle in the proton-proton collisions. Of the billions and billions of collisions analyzed by the two detector collaborations up to that point, about 50 potential Higgs candidates had been discovered. Many tests needed to be performed to get a more definitive identification, but if it walked like a Higgs and quacked like a Higgs, it probably was a Higgs. The evidence was good enough that François Englert and Peter Higgs were awarded the Nobel Prize in October of 2013, the first year possible after the claimed discovery. In February 2013, the LHC shut down so that it could finally run at its originally designed energy and luminosity. By the final weeks before turnoff, the CERN mass storage systems had stored more than 100 petabytes of data, more info than in 100 million CDs. New results continued to roll in from data that had not yet been analyzed before the first announcement, including tantalizing hints of a possible new and unexpected heavy particle, 6 times heavier than the Higgs, hints that disappeared just as this book was being sent off to press. For a real discovery, the more data you have, the better it looks, whereas anomalous results tend to disappear over time. This time things look good. Almost embarrassingly so. If one compared five different predicted decay channels into photons, Z particles, W particles, tau particles, the heaviest known cousin of the electron, and particles containing B quarks, to observation, the predictions of the standard model Higgs, with no extra accessories, agreed strikingly well. From the angular distribution and energies of the decay products with a new, larger sample of Higgs candidates, the LHC detectors were able to explore whether the particle was indeed a scalar particle, which would make it the first fundamental scalar ever observed in nature. On March 26, 2015, the ATLAS detector at CERN released results that showed with greater than 99% confidence that the new particle was a spin-zero particle with precisely the proper parity assignment to be a Higgs scalar. Nature had shown that it does not abhor scalar fields like the Higgs, as I for one had thought. The existence of such a fundamental scalar changes a great deal about what may be possible in nature, and people, including me, began to consider scenarios we would never before have considered. In September 2015, about a month before the first draft of this book was written, the two large detectors, ATLAS and CMS, combined their data from 2011 and 2012 and presented for the first time a unified comparison of theory and experiment. The result, involving a massive computational effort to take into account separate systematic effects in each experiment, involving a total of 4,200 parameters, showed with a residual uncertainty of about 10% that the new particle had all the properties predicted for the standard model Higgs. This simple conclusion may seem almost anticlimactic, following as it does a half century of directed efforts by thousands of individuals, the theorists who developed the standard model, and the others who performed the incredibly complex calculations needed to compare predictions with experiments, to determine background rates and so on, and the thousands of experimental physicists who had built and tested and operated the most complex machine ever constructed. Their story was marked by incredible heights of intellectual bravery, years of confusion, bad luck and serendipity, rivalries and passion, and above all, the persistence of a community focused on a single goal, to understand nature at her most fundamental scales. Like any human drama, it also included its share of envy, stubbornness, and vanity, but more important, it involved a unique community built completely independent of ethnicity, language, religion, or gender. It is a story that carries with it all the drama of the best epic tales and reflects the best of what science can offer to modern civilization. That nature would be so kind as to actually use the ideas that a small collection of individuals wrote down on paper, inspired by abstract ideas of symmetry, and using the complex mathematics of quantum field theory, will always seem to me nothing short of remarkable. It is hard to express the mixture of exhilaration and terror that comes from the realization that nature might actually work the way you are proposing it does when putting the final touches on a paper, possibly late at night, alone in your study. I suppose it may resemble the reaction Plato described that his poor philosophers might have as they are dragged out into the sunlight, away from the cave, for the first time. To have discovered that nature really follows the simple and elegant rules intuited by the 20th and 21st century versions of Plato's philosophers is both shocking and reassuring. It hints that the willingness of scientists to build an intellectual house of cards that could come tumbling down at the slightest experimental tremor was not misplaced. It gives us courage to continue to suppose, as Einstein had once expressed his amazement about, that the universe, on its grandest scale, is fathomable after all. After witnessing the announcement of the Higgs discovery on July 4, 2012, I wrote the following. Quote, "The apparent discovery of the Higgs may not result in a better toaster or a faster car, but it provides a remarkable celebration of the human mind's capacity to uncover nature's secrets, and of the technology we have built to control them. Hidden in what seems like empty space, indeed like nothing, which is getting more interesting all the time, are the very elements that allow for our existence. By demonstrating this, last week's discovery will change our view of ourselves and our place in the universe. Surely, that is the hallmark of great music, great literature, great art, and great science. End quote. It is too early yet to judge or even fully anticipate what changes in our picture of reality will result from the Higgs discovery at the LHC, or the discoveries that may follow. Yet fortune does favor the prepared mind, and it is at once the responsibility and the joy of theorists such as me to ponder just that. While nature may have appeared to be kind to us this time, perhaps it was too kind. The epic saga I've described here may yet provide a dramatic new challenge for physics and for physicists, and an explicit reminder that nature doesn't exist to make us comfortable. Because while we may have found what we expected, no one really expected to find just that and nothing else. Chapter 22. More Questions Than Answers. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion. Proverbs, chapter 18, verse 2. In one sense, our story might end here. Because we have come to the limits of our direct empirical knowledge about the universe at its fundamental scales. But no one says we have to stop dreaming, even if the dreams are not always pleasant. Before July 2012, particle physicists had two nightmares. The first was that the LHC would see precisely nothing. For if it did, it would likely be the last large accelerator ever built to probe the fundamental makeup of the cosmos. The second was that the LHC would discover the Higgs, period. Each time we peel back one layer of reality, other layers beckon, so each important new development in science generally leaves us with more questions than answers. But it also usually leaves us with at least the outline of a roadmap to help us begin to seek answers to those questions. The discovery of the Higgs particle, and with it the validation of the existence of an invisible Higgs field throughout space, was a profound validation of the bold scientific developments of the 20th century. However, the words of Sheldon Glashow continue to ring true. The Higgs is like a toilet. It hides all the messy details we would rather not speak of. The Higgs field, as elegant as it might be, is, within the standard model, essentially an ad hoc addition. It is added to the theory to do what is required to accurately model the world of our experience. But it is not required by the theory. The universe could have happily existed with a long-range weak force and massless particles. We would just not be here to ask about them. Moreover, the detailed physics of the Higgs is, as we have seen, undetermined within the standard model alone. The Higgs could have been 20 times heavier or 100 times lighter. Why, then, does the Higgs exist at all? And why does it have the mass it does? Recognizing once again that whenever scientists ask why, we really mean how. If the Higgs did not exist, the world we see would not exist. But surely, that is not an explanation. Or is it? Ultimately, to understand the underlying physics behind the Higgs is to understand how we came to exist. When we ask, why are we here? At a fundamental level, we may as well be asking, why is the Higgs here? And the standard model gives no answer to this question. Some hints do exist, however, coming from a combination of theory and experiment. Shortly after the fundamental structure of the standard model became firmly established in 1974, and well before the details were experimentally verified over the next decade, two different groups of physicists at Harvard